This is not a proper talk. This is just a few slides to set the discussion that we started last 2 weeks ago between the cluster workshop and the turbines workshop here at the KITP. My name is Marcus Brooks.
There are new people here, so just let's presume that we did not, like,
yeah, well,
all the basic facts need to be repeated.
Right, yes. We study clusters of galaxies, so we're astronomers who are here. Clusters of galaxies are aggregations of galaxies, so hundreds to thousands galaxies that are gravitationally bound to each other. These are the largest structures in the universe. And I'll show you here a movie that was produced by Klaus Dohlak at the MPA. It's a fairly long movie, and I'm going to start playing it now. What you see here is these various things as a function of time, as a movie, so the section of the universe that you see here. The time is indicated by this variable z, which is redshift. The higher the redshift, the further it lies in the past. This is how far spectral lines or light is stretched as the universe expands. So this number will go down. So this move will play from the past to the present. What you see here, there's a few things. The ones that I want to point out is first of all, this is the dark matter density. The whole dynamics in galaxy clusters is governed by gravity. Yeah, for astronomy, gravity is arguably the most important interaction. And so gravity dominates the total matter in the dark matter, it dominates the total matter in the universe. And you see here various blotches here, which are called halos. You can imagine that, you know, galaxies or even groups of galaxies occupy these little halos, and they move under the action of gravity, and they'll start to merge. And the stars are not even shown there. So the gas then falls into these dark matter halos. It cools. Well, it shocks first, and shocks are shown down here. The gas that shocks are there. It heats up. And this gas heats up to the virial temperature of these gravitational wells that are produced by the dark matter in here. And the virial temperatures of these clusters of galaxies stay high, higher than the central temperature of the sun, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 Kelvin. And gas of this temperature emits thermobremsstrahlung in the X-rays. And that's what most of the people here in our workshop study, the X-rays, from this gas that sits in between these galaxies. So the total baryons, and astronomers call baryons the sort of normal matter. The normal matter, the gas that sits inside this gravitational well, that's actually the dominant normal matter component. Yeah, so it's more important than the stars that eventually form by the cooling of this gas and then the condensation of this gas to form stars, to form the galaxies that you, that you probably have in mind when you think of galaxies, the pictures of what you have.
No plasma inside. It's all neutral.
Oh, so when I mean gas, I mean plasma. Yeah. So this gas is, for everything that I show here, there was a phase in the universe where the gas was neutral. But when we talk about clusters of galaxies, gases, they are permeated by gas that's ionized. Pretty much fully ionized. So we're all talking about plasma, and this is probably important when we talk about turbulence later on and other kinds of effects. So the gas density you'll see in this panel here, you will see that it closely follows the density of the dark matter.
Yeah. Just a simple question. Which one of these six pictures actually corresponds to a simple measurement? No.
So these are computer simulations here, because this is immersion in time. You can't do that, you know, from redshift of 4.1, which is actually fairly shortly after the beginning of the universe.
So if I go back to the observation, how much of this is actually observed?
Well,
let's start very simple.
What we observe is...
How much is virtual reality and how much is true?
Right. What we observe in galaxy clusters are the light from the stars. through optical telescopes or infrared telescopes, and this gas shown here, the baryons that fill the space between the galaxies, through X-ray telescopes. And now there's several other ones through Sunyaev-Zeldovich measurement, so decrements to the cosmic microwave background. But these are the dominant measurements so far. And these are measured out to...
I think you can say that in the top middle plane, everything that's bright yellow would be observed in X-rays. Right?
Yes.
At late times.
At late times.
And everything that's bright yellow in the middle bottom row also now is being observed through the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this network is not observed, but the peaks, the yellow peaks, are observed.
And the furthest we can observe this to is a redshift of 2, roughly. So the galaxy clusters, the furthest galaxy clusters that we know are lie in a redshift of 2, so closer than what you see at the moment in this snapshot.
Maybe you want to add the lower right panel, the shocks. The peaks of the shocks have also been observed indirectly by means of the electron acceleration magnetic field amplification in shocks, giving rise to synchrotron emission, which you can observe.
But in what sense all this light is shocks? What does it mean? It's like a region where you have high concentration of shocks, where we don't see single shocks there. In what sense it is called dust shock?
In geometry, that's a projection.
Projection of
projection of all shocks that dissipate the energy at this instant of time through this simulation there.
So the all shocks there in this...
You basically have to think of this as a sort of super... superposition of shocks that sort of happen at different radii onto this galaxy cluster. So that's mostly the very shock of the outer part, and some sort of Mercer shocks on the inner part that give rise to this complicated geometry.
But this is for the same Z.
This is all the same.
Like this, it's more or less in the same plane.
It's on a projection. So it's projected out the projected gas density, projected gas temperature.
It's sort of a box.
When I see white, means that there are just many shocks in this region.
Yeah. Imagine as a Mach number, as an energy flux through the shock surfaces. And that all projected throughout this region of the of space, which is several megaparsecs here. So this is actually, I'm not sure how many this is, but tens of megaparsecs. A megaparsec is 3×10^24 centimeter is a megaparsec.
Say that the shocks are envelopes around the structures.
Yeah. Let me play this movie and then you'll... let me play this movie and then...
One picture
again. This has become much clearer. This movie will actually take a little while, so I can keep talking a little bit.
Things. They all move simultaneously.
Yes, they all move simultaneously. You see how the...
Wow, I can only twice, not six.
Yeah. So the main things to look at is this. So this is the gas density, and this is the temperature. You see here how the shocks, gas falls into the wells, shocks are produced here, you can see the shock waves that go out, and these shocks heat up this gas. You can see how the gas heats up, and a galaxy cluster forms at the center here. You can see here, this big overdensity here is a galaxy cluster. You see here, it's very violent. You see there's a lot of substructure, and there are a lot of merger events, stuff falls in, falls out.
So this gas density pour, I mean in the top second, there are like bubbles going there. What is those bubbles?
We'll have
micro clusters of galaxies or it's still gas?
So these are groups of galaxies that fall in. Groups of galaxies that are also filled with gas. This is plasma. This is very dilute plasma. So particle densities are about 0.1 up to 10^-4, 10^-5 particles per cube centimeter. Yes.
The filamentary structure that we were seeing at the beginning.
Right.
Where does it come from? It's already the result of an evolution of a previous state.
That's the result of gravity, essentially. This is how structure forms in the universe. It forms into what's called a cosmic web. First forms into filaments, into walls that then they intersect at filaments, and these filaments then all cross at clusters. So this form this network of voids, filaments, walls, and clusters. This is the topology of cosmic rays that's observed and simulated.
In terms of turbulence, you would get already very nervous about resolution issues and the simulation. where do you cut off, where do you make very simplified assumptions?
I'll come to that, yes. That's what we're worried about, that's why we're here.
Are these particle simulations? Or?
So this is a gadget simulation, and that's a smooth particle hydrodynamics simulation.
So what are the equations you saw?
So this is Eulerian hydrodynamics and gravity. So this is without magnetic fields. I'll show you some other bits with more complicated stuff later. And the equations are subject to the expansion of the universe and things like this.
Could you comment on the optical depth of the system?
Right. Now, the radiation only interacts with the gas, and the gas is optically thin mostly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we look on these scales, it's so dilute, the radiation goes through it. So we have to very large. So.
And the shock waves, presumably they lose the energy of the heating very quickly. So the shocks cool rapidly.
Well, the shocks of the way as they are here, so they are so accretion shocks. Cold gas so goes through the shock, and the gas falls in and heats up to roughly the virial temperature of this well and stays hot. Yeah, and then forms that. Yeah, very simple models of galaxy clusters view them as spherically symmetric hydrostatic round structures. Obviously, from these simulations, you see that's something, depending on what you look at, that's a poor approximation.
I guess, except at the very center, the gas can't radiate away the thermal energy it acquires in the shock, and the whole age of the universe doesn't have enough time to radiate it away.
So, that's right. The cooling times are usually very, very long, except at the very center.
It's so dilute.
So the only radiation mechanism is Bremsstrahlung, which is a two-body process, so the energy loss go like n squared, density squared, and only at the centers, the losses are big enough so that they actually matter.
This is, looks like the beginning of some interesting process. Does this process have an end, or it won't end?
So what we're showing here is not that my density at rate zero. And that people do simulation to the future. Yeah, you can play this game.
So this cluster kind of start to appear, and then they would ever disappear, or it would just.
They keep going.
They keep going and just getting everything going.
And get larger. But the universe expands. And the acceleration of the universe expands.
Sorry? On this time scale, the expansion of the universe is very slow.
No. Huh? So this is in the co-moving frame, what I was showing here. Uh-huh. So the universe expands, but. I guess
it would contract, because I think there is a
the universe, the way we think it's working at the moment, the universe doesn't contract. The universe actually starts to accelerate.
No, the cluster.
I'm in a cosmology discussion.
Maybe in answer to this, because of the existence of dark energy, that sort of has negative pressure that drives away and slows down structure formation, and that's the reason why clusters are currently the biggest object in the universe and will be forever the biggest object.
And they would never disappear. I mean, the moment you have a single cluster,
they don't disappear. They keep
so
going.
Much. All this dissipation goes inside. So it would never go away, it would just kind of stay.
Yeah.
You never seen it end somehow,
no.
Or breaks into fuel?
No.
Gravity.
Because of gravity, so stone,
gravity.
Just everything goes
gravity.
In. So they are forever.
Yeah.
If you wait long enough, it may become very big black hole. I mean, if you wait very, very, very long, it becomes a big black hole.
And if you wait even longer, these black holes evaporate.
Okay. That's a really long story. That's a
appreciation. Okay.
How many order of magnitude for the matter density inside the galaxy?
You mean what's the range in density?
Average.
Well, the densities, the particle densities at the cluster edges, means 10 to the minus 4 particles per cube centimeters. And in galaxies, it can be several particles per cube centimeter. So I guess the range in scale is maybe Well, it depends on, I mean, it depends on where you stop. In stars, it's, you know, the density, the average density of the sun is the average, it's the density of water. So.
But if it's only gas, what is the interval of gas density?
10 to the
minus
4 to
10
to the
minus
1,
right?
Yeah, 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 1.
5 orders.
So the 1 is, it's 5 orders of magnitude.
3 orders.
Mm. Something like that. So,
what is the equation governs dark matter?
Gravity, just gravity. So people think most of these models, it's collisionless n-body. This is an n-body. Essentially, the dark matter is like an n-body simulation. It's just gravity. Yeah, mostly Newtonian gravity in these simulations. Right. So, okay. So let me say a little bit about turbulence. Can't really give justice to this subject here, but let me just put up some very, mention a few naive statements. I've shown you some movies of galaxy clusters, what they look like from theory's perspective. I haven't shown you actually any observations, so I might do that later. So how and where is turbulence produced in galaxy clusters? You saw this, you saw the movie, that it does look very turbulent, it does look very dynamic. Turbulence come from merger shocks. These shock waves produce turbulence. They produce vorticity because the gradient of peak cross gradient of rho produces a source term vorticity equation. Then galaxies and substructures, they move through this medium, and in their wake they stir this medium. They dissipate energy and they produce turbulence. Then there's something that's called AGN, stands for active galactic nuclei. These are every galaxy is believed to have a big supermassive black hole at its center. These black holes, they produce jets of hot gas, and these jets of hot gas, they have the dynamic influence on the gas around it, and they can stir it and heat it and produce shocks themselves and do all kinds of things. These can also be very large. Some of these extreme radio galaxies themselves have jets that are a megaparsec.
Can we identify those nuclei and say if they are uniformly distributed approximately in this cluster, or they are very, very non-uniform, and in the center of the cluster there are more galaxies and more nuclei and more AGN?
So these merger shocks, they are mainly on the, yeah, well, they are very non-uniform. The Mach numbers are very high at the edges of clusters. The Mach numbers are very small if you go to the centers of clusters. The motion of galaxies, they change as well through the galaxy cluster. They're fastest in the center. They're slightly supersonic. Most of the motions in the galaxy clusters are supersonic. These AGN, probably the effect that they have on the gas is strongest in the core of galaxy clusters. So only the central 100 kiloparsecs, possibly.
When you say galaxy is supersonic, you mean it's speed relative to the cluster, or it's a rotational speed?
No, it's velocity relative to the cluster. So yeah, they're mostly supersonic. Yeah.
But it has to be virial, and the gas temperature is also virial. So why they're supersonic? They're transonic, right?
Yeah, I guess you would call it transonic. So what does turbulence do for clusters? So there's a lot of interest in turbulence in galaxy clusters for various reasons. Turbulence might provide pressure, and the pressure is something that's measured through various effects. For example, through this Zdunjanov-Zdunjanovich effect, and we may talk about this later. Especially in the outskirts of galaxy clusters, there's evidence that turbulence provides some of the pressure in the gas. There's a whole field of instabilities, hydrodynamic and magnetohydrodynamic instabilities in galaxy clusters. Turbulence can monkey around with those.
Gene instability, the gravitational stability, isn't it going on in this process? You say it never breaks into parts, yeah?
Yeah.
So there is no...
The gene instability comes in at the galaxy level, where stars form, the molecular clouds that become genes instable and produce stars and things. For these galaxies and the structure we are looking at, that's just completely dominated by dark matter. They could heat the cluster. That's probably not true.
And why not?
Well, the heat excesses.
Yeah, because we have the energy goes there and eventually you have heating.
Yes. And, there will be some level of that, but it's. But it's not going to be going to change the picture dramatically.
And what's. So are you saying that the intercluster media has the same temperature as the temperature of the gas from which it has been formed? Or you still heat it?
No, I mean, the gas. Initially, the gas that ends up in the intercluster medium is much, much cooler, and it virializes. But
yeah, but still, taking a lot of gravitational energy, bringing, and where this energy is going according to the virial theorem, if you are continuing, so you should heat.
Yes, this I would not call heating by turbulence. I'm just wondering now the turbulence that you produce. Yeah, well, if you talk about, if you see it like this, then of course turbine produces all the heat in the gas cluster, right? I'm just talking about the turbine motions and gas clusters that we see now, and you see what's the turbine dissipation if you the viscous scale, and that rate is now no longer important. But but yeah, if you say all the turbines that's produced by the shocks, then yeah. It's important. There's a whole plasma physics aspect to it that the turbines can accelerate particles. Particles meaning so either through shocks or through turbulence, through Fermi 1 or Fermi 2 acceleration. Fermi 1 acceleration is the acceleration in shocks. So particles, I mean, magnetic fields are here. So there's also turbulence can also produce, for example, by creating pressure anisotropies, it can create magnetic fields. There's some experts here, Alex and others.
You want to explain to us what a particle is?
What is?
What a particle is.
A particle is, so these are actually elementary particles, so electrons and protons. So these electrons and protons can be accelerated to huge energies, GeVs, and much, much more. There's cosmic rays that are measured on Earth. These are really highly relativistic particles. They go up to 10 to the 21 EV.
And you know that they came from clusters?
Well, not all of them. So they come from a plethora of sources.
From supernova.
Yeah. They come from a plethora of sources. But there's some particles that are innate to clusters. And they can be seen by the synchrotron emission that these relativistic particles produce in the body of the cluster. So these are called radio halos, and shocks produce particles. Christoph mentioned that earlier. At shock fronts, you can see they light up in synchrotron emission. You see directly relativistic energies. Yeah, gamma of 10 to the 4.
Yeah. The lifetime of electrons that I've seen in the radio are much smaller than. They can fly through the cluster, so they must be accelerated in the cluster.
And they can, the turbines mixes stuff, it mixes metals, and that can be measured through X-ray, spectroscopy, and entropy, things like that. So this is I think, my...
How you measure? I mean, maybe a few words, that's very interesting. So you measure what mixes? The metals are produced in one place and they are found in another place?
Yeah, so the metals are presumed to be produced in the stars, in the galaxies, but they don't stay there. The gas in between the galaxies is also enriched in metals. That can only be produced in the nuclear synthesis in stars.
Right.
So they need to be transported from the stars and the gravitational wells of the individual galaxies to the cluster as a whole.
And you find them outside?
And you find them outside by measuring emission lines in the X-ray spectra. Yeah, so you measure the X-ray emission from the intercluster medium, and it's Bremsstrahlung plus spectral lines, mainly emission lines, and you can measure these. You measure things like neon, nitrogen, silicon, oxygen lines, and there you can measure exactly the metallicity. And the metallicity in this cluster is in this is, what did you say, something?
And iron.
Especially iron.
Especially iron. Yeah.
Yeah,
so these are the products of star stellar explosions, essentially. The stars they produce winds, and eventually they die and they explode in supernovae. Various kinds of supernovae produce different kinds of signatures in the elements, and these are then transported outwards. Mm-hmm. And this is measured in the gas. So, yeah, and this is...
Does baryonic matter have a back reaction on dark matter or not?
Yes. Well, it's gravitationally, they're both gravitationally coupled, so...
But is there some order magnitude, like, how much more...
Well, you could say that...
How much mass is
there? Give
the mass ratio.
What's the mass ratio? It's sort of 90% of the...
10-15%.
10-15%, yeah. It's baryonic matter, and the rest is dark matter. So that gives you. So that's why I'm saying everything is dominated by dark matter. Yeah. So, not getting very far. There's some evidence for turbulence in galaxy clusters. So far, I've just shown you pretty movies that come out of simulations. There's a whole bunch of studies and lines of evidence where people look at what turbulence does. I'll just mention them pretty here. The metallicity has been measured in clusters, so there's some mixing must have gone on. You can look at the optical depth of certain spectral lines, and the optical depth goes down if you stir the medium. Because of the Doppler shift of all the spectral lines, and you can measure the optical depth of certain lines, of certain X-ray lines. You can measure this, so this gives you some handle on the turbulence in the medium. You can also look at the pressure of it. You can measure the potential in big elliptical galaxies through essentially the motion of certain objects in that potential, and you can measure the pressure that you would get to in order to achieve hydrostatic equilibrium in that potential, and you can compare these two. So this compares the X-ray the constraint you get from hydrostatic equilibrium to the circular optical velocities, and you see that you can compare these two, and the mismatch must be non-thermal pressure. So this could be cosmic rays, it could be magnetic fields, it could be turbulence. These methods are probably most sensitive to the cores of galaxy clusters, where you get most photons in these methods.
And what is the second plot? This is not... These are not observations. These are some.
So this is a calculation. So this is, but this has been compared to observations as well. So this is worked by Eugene.
And do you have any error?
I don't. No. This is worked by Norbert Werner. No, I don't actually. I don't have the measurements here on this plot. What these generally find is that the turbulence in the centers of the galaxy clusters and these big elliptical galaxies is actually not too large. It's only sort of 10% of the pressures provided by the turbulent pressure compared to the thermal pressure.
Turbulent broadening of emission lines, has it been observed?
Yes, people claim this. People looked at it with XMM Newton. This is a satellite.
It's an upper limit. Sorry. Okay. It has been observed.
Okay.
It's an upper limit.
Okay.
That's what
they have to
say.
What is the idea behind turbulence decreasing optical depth?
Right. If you have if you have resonance scattering if you've got photons from a certain spectral lines and it resonantly scatters, multiply through various atoms, if all these atoms move with respect to each other, the Doppler shift changes that spectral line, and that of course decreases the cross section for the resonance scattering, just by these motions. So that reduces the optical depth of that particular line. And that's what you can observe. This is another picture now of a grid simulation, Eulerian grid simulation of the temperature. Of a galaxy cluster. So this is work by a postdoc of mine, Frank Cavazza. We see here is a bit more than 8 megaparsecs, the size of the box, and this is the temperature structure in a particularly, just after a particularly violent merger. You see, it's very, very patchy. It looks very, very turbulent. Well, what astronomers call turbulent. There's lots of other people. Daisuke Nagai is here. There's Dong Su Ryo here, who measure these things, who measure shock waves in cluster in structure formation, measure the amplification of magnetic fields. So this, here you see the shock structure, for example. So you see the Mach numbers, the color coding is the Mach numbers. You see the shock structures around a forming galaxy cluster.
So you mean calculated numerically?
Yeah, so this is the simulations. Yeah. All of this is what the simulations were showing you now. People have measured, I'm sure how well you can see this, people have measured now in these simulations, so they look just, so these are Eulerian simulations, sometimes AMR, sometimes unigrid simulations. They measure the ratio between the turbulent pressure or the thermal pressure for various, as a function of radius, up to the virial radius in here. And you can see that the contribution to the centers, it's generally found to be only of the order of 10%, can go up to 1 at the edges of galaxy clusters. Clusters in various dynamical states differ. This is a classification according to the merging history of galaxy clusters, and you can see that the relaxed ones that haven't had a major merger for a certain time, they have a much lower contribution of the turbulent pressure in the center and throughout. Whereas the ones that are just merging or have just merged have much higher contributions to the pressure in here. These kind of studies are important. They're important for Zinoviev-Zeldovich measurements at the moment, but directly measure the pressure in galaxy clusters in here. Now, how do you measure turbulence in numerical simulations? So this is something where I think we can probably learn from people who do this professionally. This is quite difficult. So in these grid simulations, what's generally done, so that we try quite a few methods. One thing you can do is in the center of mass of the galaxy cluster, you can make a power spectrum of the 3D velocity field. This is what these power spectra look like. You can define the peak of where the energy lies, and you can filter out everything above in K larger than that, say that's your turbulence, and you can, that gives you one handle on this.
You try to fit it by K minus 2?
No, it's not a fit, you can see.
If you would K minus 2, that would probably, which would be shocks spectrum.
Right.
That would probably be
closer to it. And there's various people, yes.
Is this averaged over everything within the virial radius, or is this at a particular
radius?
This
is volume averaged over four times the virial radius. So
okay,
you larger,
so it's really going to be weighted then towards the outskirts.
Yes. Mm. So this is probably why it's...
Also, this is done in highly homogeneous medium, so interpretation of it is good.
Yeah, it's the same density contrast we talked about earlier. So yes. This is one thing that I always have a hard time figuring out how to characterize turbulence. Because the density changes from one point to another, so it's highly stratified. So how do you even define power spectrums?
You will define structure functions.
So I give structure functions.
Structure.
And also, they are anisotropic.
Yeah.
Really, you can say, okay, this.
Another complication comes in from that many of
these. There's also another technique I can show how to separate density and velocity fluctuations.
Yeah. Another complication that's swept under the carpet here is that many of these simulations are irregular. So either a particle simulation, these are based on grid simulations, and many grid simulations are adaptive mesh simulations. So you've got big boxes and small boxes. Yeah. So this particular work actually enforced maximum resolution all the way out. It's very challenging. So in this, I think the numerical challenge here is, first of all, you need a huge box to have a large enough part of the universe to get a proper range of galaxy clusters that you find in your box. And at the same time, you need very high resolution through a large fraction of the volume of the cluster in order to make statements about turbulence. Yeah. And even here, the maximum resolution about 25 kiloparsec. Yeah. So that's by normal standards.
In a single run of resolution, you want to really resolve few clusters, not a single cluster.
Yeah, yes. Well, there's usually these studies are based on resimulation. So first you do a big simulation of big cosmology block where you get all kinds of galaxy clusters in it, and then you, at some point, you regrid them, and then you take them individually and then study the turbulence in these ones.
Back to this, unfortunately, I wasn't here when you had the earlier discussion about using structure functions. So they're just correlation functions?
Just those two different or density differences,
right?
And then it depends on which direction you take the distance.
Yeah. So, I mean, at some level, they're Fourier transforms of each other if you can do this properly. But when you actually do density fluctuations in a medium like this one, which is highly compressive as well as having this overall sort of mean, very, very steep shape. How do you try and characterize that? What is the definition of a correlation function that you're actually using in order to take that out?
It very much depends on your geometry. I mean, naively saying that you have some kind of a spherical type geometry, so you would definitely don't want to average over different radius. So you would stay on some radius. He said, okay, on this radius, around this radius, I take 2 points. And just not a difference, because I suspect that density could be a small-scale field. If you have something which is small-scale field, you do correlation function. You do rho at 1 point times rho at another point. If you have a smooth field, then you take difference. Rho at 1 point minus rho at another point, that's your random variable. But generally, I suspect that for density, even just correlation function, you take rho at 0.1, rho at 0.2, but both points 1 and 2 at the same radius. Then you have two ways of averaging. You can just average over time as this radius. On time, relatively small compared to this difference between blue and white or this merging, post-merging. Or you can also try to average over kind of a shell of the same radius, because you want to characterize fluctuation at this region, because you definitely your turbulence is different outside and in the core. So you don't want to average over. And on the other hand, you can take this both 2 points with the same radius, or you can take these 2 points at different radius, and then you can say, okay, now I will see an isotropy. So all my shocks, let's say, go this way, so this would give you a large, and this would give you more or less 2 points on the same shock, on average would give you. So with this correlation function, really, in R space, and it's idiotic to do Fourier because it's highly non-uniform. This will really tell you what is your turbulence, how it's anisotropic, and how it changes as you go towards the core.
Yeah, basically, what you're saying that one has to work in shells, in radial shells.
One way to work in shells.
Delta R or the order of R would give you 6 shells, but then within those shells, you either build correlation function or structure function, or even you can make Fourier transform if you want.
Look,
you can correct.
Yeah, you can do linear functions always.
Yeah.
I would have expected something like this, that presumably one has sort of a mean field density structure, and we're looking at fluctuations on it. So it would suggest, number one, you should take out that large-scale mean, just like one does when you're doing turbulent.
We do it, but on the other hand, I suspect that your density fluctuations are actually large. It's not that you have a mean density and a small fluctuations around it.
No, the turbulence is small, so density fluctuations in a given place.
The main thing is the mean field.
Yeah, well, then of course you subtract local means.
I think the necessary thing is you divide by one way or another. I think my view is that the log of rho over rho smooth is probably the right way to do the measure.
Well, it's very difficult to then construct a meaningful structure function.
Yeah. And the thickness of the shell is probably a scale height, a typical scale height. The thickness of the shell.
Yeah, but every time turbulence people talk about correlation function or anything else, they always mean cumulants. Just always, that's default. It's our correlation function are cumulants, they characterize turbulence. Which means we always subtract all the mean values, always subtract all the for higher moments, always subtract all the reducible contributions. It's always common. Okay. That's a measure of
Now, of course, if you have magnetic fields in there as well, things become very different. So there's a simulation by Tom Jones in Minneapolis, who I visited 2 weeks ago. They've got this fancy 3D screen in the basement of the Minneapolis Supercomputing Center, and they have this sort of sitting there with these goggles in there, and it's kind of amazing. I mean, this is really doesn't do justice to this at all. It's kind of amazing where you see that. So this is driven turbulence in a uniform grid in, I think, a 2048 cube simulations. So where they drive the turbulence on some scale, and you can see here the first got a lot of turbulence that developed from the small scale. So here's the magnetic field density. You see the small eddies wind up fastest the magnetic field. So it grows very quickly on these small scales, and then you get an inverse cascade later on. You see magnetic, you see structure, you see these ribbons, doing that structure that's characteristic of MHD turbulence on these large scales at later times.
Is this the highest resolution MHD turbulence simulation ever done? I think it might be.
So close.
Well, let's go. So this, yeah, here is.
Mine drops. Speaking of, did they measure the rate of reconnections, for example, in this?
This is not super spectral.
This is no spectral code. Is that what you mean?
No,
it's. So this, I'm not sure what, I think it's constraining transport, some variant of constraint.
I think we have a TVD map.
Yeah, for finding differences of the
constraints. Yeah, so find a difference, uniform grid.
Isothermal or what?
It's isothermal, and I think it's supersonic. Does anybody know better?
Well, if this is a representation of clusters, that has to be subsonic.
I'm not sure. I have to check.
So it started from really small seats. I mean,
they actually drive it on very large scales, but the magnetic field grows fastest on the small scale.
Yeah, that's sure. Yeah, but it's
in this direction.
What are the boundary conditions?
Periodic.
So why did I see some symmetry on this image? So why do I see the boundaries? Is there some anisotropy in the grid or something? Or how do I see the four sides? How do I know that it's a square? If you showed this to me on just a picture periodically, I would tell you there's a square. So why do I see a square?
I don't know the way this picture's done.
What goes out comes from the right.
Yeah, but you see the symmetry. Look, you see the grid.
It's doors.
Yeah. You see the grid?
You see the doors.
There might be a mean field, so.
There must be something that makes me break the symmetry of the symmetry.
Let's just move because.
See the way they're driving it. Maybe the way they're driving it. They measure things like the cascade, they measure power spectra, see how the magnetic field grows as a function of time in the Cauchy unit as the kinetic energy goes down. So they measure the transfer between the kinetic energies. And it's the time, I think. We should maybe get to something else. Talk, maybe just list the topics that we're interested in. For the last minute, so that we can have some more discussion. I wrote this down last time when we had some internal session. The measurement of turbine spectra, and how to measure it in a stratified environment. We already talked about that last time. We talked about this now. Maybe we should use structure functions rather than power spectra. So many astronomers use power spectrum. There's probably only limited information in these. And transport processes in turbine media. I haven't talked much about this, but transport processes could be very important. So what do I mean by transport processes? So I mean things like viscosity, thermal conduction.
Is there any clear challenge here, for example, of this metallicity that you mentioned, that you have some profiles, or you have something, like in ocean we have some data which shows that there are mixing occurs during the time which we cannot explain how it so fast.
Yeah.
If you could have some data which tells us that something is so far that you don't know how it got there, like something like a challenge for turbulent, people to try to explain, get a model.
Right,
so
yeah, I think
interesting to have something like this.
People have played games of looking at metallicity profiles, knowing what we're measuring, modeling the source term of it, and trying to model
and
deriving some diffusion coefficient from it and trying to say what turbine is, that's turbine diffusion, what turbine velocities of this is. I think there's plenty of applications where there is data, and the modeling of turbulence, or the proper modeling of the turbulence, could be crucial. Yeah, I think there are. I'm sure people can come up with that as well. Yeah, I wrote this up. There was a talk. We talked about this already last time. I think this is sort of, I think you answered that last time.
I hope so.
We talked about this, where we talked about the additional terms, the higher order terms for transonic turbulence. MSU turbulence is something that's, I guess, on everybody's mind. The interfacial medium is always magnetized. The beta is probably fairly high, maybe 100 is the beta. So where's the magnetic field come from? What does it do? What does it do to transport processes? How does it, how does it affect the spectra? How can we properly describe it? Other ways. So I think this is certainly an area where certainly I could use some education, probably me and my colleagues as well. Subgroups of turbulence as well, something that I've been working on. For things like Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities or Rishmayer-Meshkov instabilities are important for bubbles or the shock waves that sweep through density inhomogeneities. There's hydrodynamic instabilities that come up. These are very difficult to model because very often the smaller scales grow fastest. So there's various subgrid approaches that people have used in the fluids community that we've adapted to model this, to model how turbulence then affects these instabilities. It's the mixing that goes with it, things like this. So here, I'd be very interested to hear what's going on there. Finally, something that I alluded to in the beginning was particle acceleration, how you can accelerate electrons and protons to these ridiculously high energies in turbulent plasmas through interaction of waves. This morning we had a non-thermal discussion group, and Alex already gave us his view of the things and explained some of his papers to us. So this is all that I wrote down, and maybe there are other things that my colleagues have thought of, yeah.
I don't know, I could try to answer the first question.
All right.
Okay. Take care. How much time do you need for it?
Well, 3 minutes, 5 minutes.
5 minutes,
I have a quick question.
So while here, please.
If you say turbulence, do you mean by baryonic matter?
Oh, yes, yes. So what I mean is only the turbulence of the baryonic matter.
There are more questions,
I don't flee. Yeah.
I have another quick question. Right. Most of the mass is in the dark matter.
Right.
And can you say something about what the dark matter is doing? Does that have itself turbulent fluctuations in its density, velocity? And does the motion of the dark matter drive the turbulence of the visible matter, the baryonic matter?
Well, in some ways it does, because this whole structure formation, the whole stirring, the whole infall of structures into the cluster, the whole motion of the galaxies inside the galaxy cluster, this is all dominated by the motion of the dark matter halos in those potentials, in these respective potentials. So this is essentially, at the bottom of it, it's all the dark matter is driving gravity, so dark matter is driving the entire dynamics.
Mm-hmm. For ignorant, dark matter is a uniform density state, or it also has a very strong density fluctuations?
No, it's got also very strong density fluctuations.
But you can think about dark matter as a turbulence because it's collisionless.
Yes.
There's no dissipation. Dissipation only happens through collective gravitational interactions. So you cannot develop the cascade, for example.
I mean, you didn't know what is dark matter. I mean, you speak like.
Well, so when we say about dark matter, we assume something, but this assumption has been tested against all kinds of observations. So we're not completely sure what dark matter is or what its exact properties are. But collisionless dark matter is suggested by direct, actually, cluster observations that provide some of the strongest evidence. Mm-hmm. Because you see in some systems where you have a merger, you see dark matter actually, because you can observe it through gravitational lensing, for instance, you see dark matter and baryons being separated because baryons feel ramp pressure and dark matter doesn't. And you see them separate.
So that gives you a limit and constraint on the interaction.
It's a very naive question. When you say you're plotting a plot of dark matter, what is actually plotted?
Well,
what
happened?
What field? What is
the plots that I've shown are simulation results, so we know.
No, well, what do you plot? I mean, what do you plot?
Density,
Source of gravity. Okay, so yeah, it was a gravitational field, right? And why does nobody plot the gravitational field, or is that also a problem?
Big sample.
The source is like, also, if you solve my fluid equation, I worry about temperature fields, and this, when I do some convection, I would worry about velocity and temperature. That's all the fields I have. And clearly, gravity is one of your fields that's very important. And it probably has an inverse, has a cascade, it probably has all its own little structure.
Okay, let's give, because we have 7 minutes left and maybe somebody want to comment on your talk. So
Reinventing a wheel, going on in the cross-cutting. Really, the interstellar media is already a bit advanced in that respect. And we now have some techniques which allow us to find out the spectrum of turbulence when we don't have a good coverage of the plane of our image. So we have, for example, here I could show a sparse measurements of the spectral lines in individual directions, rather than cover a cavity. And we developed a technique which we called velocity. I always forget what we call it. Velocity correlation spectrum, I think. Yeah, because the correlation are done. Correlation are done not in terms of spatial correlations, but along the velocity projection. So to get spectrum from such measurements, you don't need full coverage, and I'll show you numerical simulations which show how it can be done. So, if you measure, for example, this velocity correlations along the velocity direction, so spectrum of the spectrum in some sense, in this case you get some power law. And this power law, we developed a theory which relates to the underlying velocity and density statistics. And because these are different geometry, there can be a line of sight geometry, there could be crossing lines of sight, which is applicable to some parts of nearby gas, for example, the gas in the solar wind. But for clusters of galaxies, actually, parallel lines of sight is applicable. And these symbols, gamma and m, are the symbols m correspond to the power law of the structure functions of the velocity, and gamma is the power law of the structure of density. These are asymptotic regimes, but we now developed the techniques where even if you don't have a nice power law, you can get the entire spectrum, and it has been already tested. So now the possibility which I would like to attract your attention is using the adsorption lines. And for example, these are restoration of Kolmogorov power spectrum in the turbulent volume when we have only 10 points. So we measured 10 measurements of the lines in our turbulent in synthetic observations, and we can restore pretty well the power spectrum. because this is, was intended for interstellar audience, this is shown cluster, cloud, but it could be a cluster and could be absorption lines. And actually I was told that, excuse me, any question?
This is like a light scattering technique?
No, it's not light scattering at all. You have absorption lines. This is an absorption profile that you are getting, and then you correlate within this absorption profiles, because
I should be able to do the same thing with a pot of water, that I put something inside and I send light in,
sure.
And I am observing it.
Yes, yes, yes.
It also measures velocity too.
Yeah, if you have velocity.
Then correlated with the velocity.
Yeah, because they know the velocity, that's the problem, that I wouldn't have that.
I don't assume any velocity that I know. For example, we obtained with simulations, and then synthetic observations of these simulations, and this is what was done. This is I already showed in my talk, so I would not develop on it. These techniques have been used for a number of astrophysical sources, and for example, this is some data which was obtained with for this is velocity spectrum, this is density spectrum.
It's important that you imply this to supersonic turbulence. Therefore, I mean, you, in principle, different regions are separated in the velocity spectrum.
No, it's not that, but you mentioned something important. You need to have line broadening comparable or larger than the natural line width, thermal line width. You can go beyond the thermal line width, but the noise is increasing. We tried this, and it's working if you have light. So you need to better take heavy elements, not hydrogen, but heavy elements for that.
But also, it's not clear to me, so how does this work in in highly stratified atmosphere, because it would be sensitive to where most of the absorption is happening.
In the same way as Grisha was telling you, you should try, there's no good way of describing non-homogeneous turbulence.
We're also emission lines. So
emission lines is also, but I was talking about absorption lines, but because I recently learned
I want to make sure that we capture your statement.
Sure.
There. And I want to make sure we got it right. There is no theoretical way to capture inhomogeneous turbulence. Is that what your comment was?
By spectrum.
Yeah.
I want to understand, I mean, many of these star-forming clouds are expected to be highly homogeneous, centrally concentrated, so how do you measure spectra for them? What do they mean?
It's an interesting question, and it's already, it has a long history in the interstellar media. In reality, what's happening? We see substantial variations on particular scales. For example, if we have a cluster, and this is we also do with our numerical simulations. In our numerical simulations with self-gravity, we have also concentrated regions. And then when we take a spectrum, power spectrum, we see a particular bump at the corresponding. So this is giving us a clear evidence. We have a non-homogeneous turbulence, and this is part where, well, there is something is happening.
You can do a line of sight, so you're measuring turbulence within the region that produces absorption, and that's localized, and in that sense it makes sense. And if you measure it in a different line of sight, you measure it in a different region.
Yeah, so you try to have statistics, you have to have more or less, try to find more or less a homogeneous sample for your measurements to have some sense. And you can use both the spectral, which I was using, or you can use the same technique with correlation functions along. Okay, so the only thing, because I'm running out of time, at some point we were asked to do calculations for the proposal of constellation X, and this is our calculations. We were saying whether we can get Kolmogorov spectrum, and what we found that indeed with constellation X we could do the same as applicable to what is this? Japanese Astra E or Astra F?
H.
Pardon?
H.
H. Oh, now H. Okay. But it's the same. Yes. But what I learned very recently is that actually the people who are using Hubble telescope contacted me, and they said that they see absorption lines with substantial line width, not thermal line width, with the course, and they're trying to use the technique. So,
one very short question. So, if I want to do this in an experiment on Earth, would that work or not?
Yes.
So just an absorbing material and a turbulent flow, passive scalar, and it's absorbing, and I set a laser beam coming in at the right frequency with a nice absorption line in the atmosphere, possibly.
Yes.
So just atmospheric observations, I could do the same thing.
Yes.
Have people done it?
No.
The line on Earth is very wide because of the collisions.
You will need a dilute gas for very high velocities.
But that's what I'm trying to figure out.
For particular, it depends on your setup. In general, if you get the issue is that you should get beyond the natural width. You shouldn't see Doppler broadening to use Doppler broadening.
Okay, I just want to remind turbulent people that we have another meeting in an hour. And again, like we said last time, all this is just to know each other better and then go to the corridors and offices and talk to, you know, real.